Welcome, everyone, to Rock M Nation Podcast. This is Dive Cuts. I'm Sam Snelling. With me is Matt Harris. It is Christmas Eve. It is Christmas Eve morning. So probably the first episode of Dive Cuts where I'm not enjoying a tasty glass of bourbon. Instead, it's a nice little sparkling water. Good morning, Matt. How are you?
I'm well. Columbia is very crisp this morning, also very windy. And I'm proud to say people are staying home because I went to the grocery store this morning and it was empty. So good job, Columbia. Good job you for staying home.
Yeah, it's hopefully it's kind of hitting home now that like 325,000 people have died from the coronavirus, that maybe this thing is serious. This Christmas is going to be a little different for us. Normally, we have everybody over on Christmas Eve. We cook a big meal. My parents are coming over just to look at the tree. We're not feeding them. Might have a drink, but everything's going to be, like, distance. Not going to even see my brother or my nephews. It's fun. Merry Christmas.
But hey, Mizzou... They gave a present to everyone. And, you know, maybe it wasn't quite what you thought you wanted, but then you opened it at the end and you were happy. Let's really punish that metaphor right there. Let's do a real bad job with it.
Yeah, it was as much of a stinker of a basketball game as you could have hoped for, until like the last, I think 3 minutes and 44 seconds is about the amount of time it took for Missouri to go from 8 down to 1 point up. So let's talk about this a little bit. I did the study hall on it. You did the lineups breakdown. We know as much as we probably need to know about Bradley and sort of what they're capable of. I mean, Bradley, we knew this could kind of have the potential to be ugly because of the way Bradley kind of prefers to play. They're a very big, athletic team. They defend well. They actually have like the number one defense for 2-point field goal percentage in the country right now. So it's not a surprise that it was like a close game. I think it was surprising that Missouri struggled to make shots as much as they did. And I mean, probably didn't help that they could get nothing going from the outside, aside from a couple strokes of luck from Xavier Pinson. But it was a fight, and credit to Mizzou, they found a way to win at the end. But man, that was if the phrase "skin of your teeth" is adequate anywhere, it's adequate here.
Yeah. I think it's a lot like the Liberty game. You kind of came in and knew what the opponent was going to do. You knew kind of how they were going to approach this, and it was just how quickly could you find a way to sort of troubleshoot it. And it took 37 minutes to do it, but they figured it out. And I think the one thing that sort of stood out to me about the game is there are two things, and I'll start with the good. One, mentally, this group is just in a far more resilient place than the past couple of years, and I think that's what happens anytime you get older. I think you develop a sense of chemistry with guys. You understand who you are. You've been in these sorts of situations. You can draw on what you've done poorly in the past, and not that you're like thinking about it in the moment, but you just have a nice sort of, you have some scar tissue there that reminds you of what's happened in the past, and I think you understand when you've learned from it. And I think down the stretch they did a good job, plugging away. You know, they kept trying different stuff in the second half offensively, and then they finally just decided, we're just going to try and get to the rim and all get out and make the officials have to decide to make a call or not. And it worked. I mean, I think, you know, Mark was better down the stretch at, you know, trying to play off the bounce. You know, there are some people who said, you know, why wasn't Mark, you know, maybe, why was he seeming hesitant at times to shoot when he was open and putting the ball on the deck more? It's like, well, if he's not knocking down jumpers, and that's what you're being given, go to the rim. You know, go, even if you're not going to complete the play, at least you're going to force the official to put you on the line and you can convert there. they finally started getting some post-ups to Tillman and getting him some opportunities to go to work, and that was big. The last play of the game, obviously, was a play they had struggled to make all night, which was either hitting a guy in the short corner or hitting a roll man, and they pulled it off at the right time, late, but they got it done. But I think the biggest thing was that there was just a resilience there, and they also got stops at the other end. You know, I think people were focusing on the offense, but in the second half for a long stretch, they were allowing 50%+ shooting and 1.1 points per possession. It doesn't matter what you're doing offensively if you're not getting stops. And I think that was the other issue for them was Bradley started to figure out some things that they could do in pick and rolls and in ball screens, and they had their guy knock down some jumpers, and, you know, it was a two-prong thing they had to do. They had to get stops, and they had to unlock something offensively, and it didn't matter if you did one without the other. And you're not going to get style points for it, but they figured it out in time.
Yeah, I think there's kind of a couple ways that you can look at the game, and I tried to kind of outline a little bit in study halls, saying that, I mean, for anyone who might be kind of critical of the roster and sort of like the kind of team that Iconzo has built, I mean, like, this is all the things that you were going to be critical about. I mean, it's a team that kind of lacks shooters. It's a team that does struggle to score points. They've made a lot of changes late last season and so far in this season, as far as getting out in transition more, getting into that early clock offense faster, doing what they can to mitigate what is very clearly a problem. And I don't think, like, I do think it's important to kind of keep context on it as far as, like, yes, Missouri is not a good shooting basketball team. They also had, like, a historically bad shooting night. And that's not going to happen, like, every game. Now, is it possible they go, like, 3-for-18 from three-point range again this year? Yeah, it's very likely that's going to happen. They're also probably not going to go, I think it ended up being, like, what, 16 out of 56 or 58 from field goals overall. Like, I don't think that's as likely to happen the rest of the season. So it is one of those things where you kind of have to balance, like, yeah, like, if they have a bad shooting night, it's going to be difficult for them to win now that they're getting into SEC conference play. But I think we also have to realize that, like, this was as bad of a shooting night as Missouri is probably capable of having. Like, that was atrocious. Nothing was going right. They were struggling to make shots all around the court. And there was absolutely, like, I really feel like the thing that kind of turned the game was Bradley went to a zone. And, you know, and like, you and I kind of discussed it privately. I actually liked the move. I thought it was good. Like, give Missouri another thing to think about on the offensive end when they've absolutely struggled. I think the broadcasters kind of were a little critical of it, saying, like, you have this thing that's going well. And it threw Missouri off for like two or three possessions. But then they were doing a good job of getting the ball in the middle of the court and getting the ball to Mitchell Smith. He I think, had one kind of threw the ball to Jeremiah Tillman and kind of threw it away a little bit. It was when he had that just catch turn jump shot and drained it. And it was almost like, and I don't know, there was just a feeling that I had. It's just like, all right, maybe they can actually do this and come back. Like, that's the kind of shot that they needed to see go in. And then I think a possession or two later, like Pinson hits his little runner. And the next thing you know, like, you know, they're right there within striking distance. So, as good of a move as I think it was to go to the zone, maybe Wardle stuck to it a little too long and gave Missouri an easy out to kind of figure it out.
Yeah. The one thing I would I keep coming back to is, as we talked about the shooting issues, is, you know, Konzo Martin says, you know, we've got good shooters. You know, but if you look at the data for the last, back to the last season through this part of this year, it's very clear they don't, outside of Mark Smith. Like, if you, so I think, and I, that's not a criticism, it's just, and I get that Zoe's not going to get up on a podium or sit on a Zoom post game and say, we shoot like crap.
Right, like
he's not going to do that.
John Calipari says the same thing. Like, oh man, in practice we scorched the Nets. It's like, I'm skeptical of that.
but when you look at Mizzou's like jump shooting percentage, like Missouri the last year has shot around 30% on unguarded jumpers. The national average is 37.5. Missouri's field goal percentage on open three pointers, you know, going back to the 16th game of last year, has been in near constant decline. They outside of Mark Smith, they do not knock down open jumpers very well. They reoriented the offense, as we've talked about in previous pods and as I wrote about in the preseason. The idea of going to the pick-and-roll-based offense and getting corner threes was not we want to hunt that shot, we want to create that shot specifically, but if we're going to create kickouts, let's create kickouts to the most advantageous spot on the floor for shooters, because our guys aren't good. Like, if we're going to create threes, let's take them from the most optimal spot on the floor. That has not necessarily borne itself out. Kobe Brown is still struggling to shoot. Xavier Pinson is 2 of 10 on open threes this year. Drew Smith is a little better, but he's only attempted 5 of them. Mitchell Smith is not any better. So the question is, at some point, it's not the shots you're creating, it's the guy shooting them. And so I say that to make this point here. Missouri's not going to become, I think, a top-end shooting team. What they need to find is another floor spacer, or find a guy who can get to 35%. They don't need to be a team full of snipers. They just need one other guy on the floor who can do that for them. Because you have to sit Mark Smith, because right now, the way they're rotating guys in, it's hard when you take Mark Smith off the floor. The offense just grinds. They played a lot of possessions with Javon Pickett, Mitchell Smith, and Parker Brown. And when you have Drew Buggs on the floor at the point, that is just, it doesn't matter if Pinson's out there. That is an offense where you can see defenses just basically go into what's bordering on zone and man. They just pack line the hell out of them and just say, shoot. And so Missouri's key is, can they find one other semi-functional shooter to put on the floor so they can at least rest Mark and they can at least, you know, maintain some semblance of flow for the offense? Because you can really tell when the starters or when three of the starters are out and when the reserves are in. It just bogs heavily. They've worked around it by getting into secondary breaks, but as we've seen with Bradley, teams will bail out a little bit on the defensive glass or bail out a little bit on the offensive glass. Bradley was better about going to the glass, actually. But teams have bailed out, gotten in transition, set up, made it hard for Missouri to hunt those early clock possessions. And then they did what Bradley did, which is they just go under screens, they sit back and drop coverage, and they basically say, we can put three guys between you and the rim, go finish. Now Missouri's run at the foul count, and that's what saved them against Bradley, is they started to get the foul count. And so when I talk about Missouri's unlocked some things, when they're assertive and they play off the bounce a little bit and then put the onus on the officials, they can get to the line as a way to offset that three-point shooting. But that's going to get harder as the year goes on. And so I think you take stock in the fact that they unlocked a way to win, but we've seen in the past couple of games that if the shooting doesn't come around or they don't get one other guy, teams have figured out the scout on this group. And I think that's the one thing going into SEC play that's going to be interesting to watch, is how this group tries to figure out what it's going to do, because the personnel is what it is at this point, and and SEC teams know it, we know it. They need to get a little bit better performance from one other guy or two other guys on the roster to at least keep the balance where it is, to where they can keep making the pick and roll based system work for them, or else it's going to be back to where they were a year ago, where it's just a slog.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that is also kind of important, and I think Dane Bradshaw kind of pointed this out during the broadcast the other night, is even if you do have the right scout, you still have to have the personnel to execute it. And it's sort of like, it's kind of like going back to what we were talking about with Missouri's offensive struggles last year. The problem wasn't the offense. They ran good offense. The problem was it was generating shots for guys who weren't making them. And I do think that there is, there is a bit of an opening for Missouri in conference play, in that not everybody has the personnel to play like they did against, to play like Bradley defensively, to play like Liberty defensively. That's not how Arkansas is wired. That's not how LSU is wired. That's not how like South Carolina is wired. Tennessee, certainly capable. They don't really play at a super high pace. Mississippi State, I still think that's a game that Missouri should be able to win. I just don't think Mississippi State has the personnel offensively to really do much outside of one guy. Auburn doesn't want to play that way. You know, Kentucky doesn't want to play that way. Alabama doesn't. So, you know, when you kind of look at it from that, like, these are very concerning issues, and if Missouri doesn't find somebody who can knock down, just be a threat to knock down shots with some level of consistency outside of Mark Smith, then it is going to be more of a slog. I still think this is a team that can win maybe 11 or 12 games in conference play. But, how are you winning those games? And if you're slogging to a 2-point win against Mississippi State, if you're, you know, beating LSU by a point, yeah, I mean, those are wins, and I mean, wins are always going to be better. But it's certainly going to be a lot harder than if you, like, even if Xavier Pinson is able to find a way to shoot 32% instead of 28%. Kobe Brown, if he can, you know, get to 30% instead of, you know, 22%. I think, like, Mitchell Smith is a guy who, you know, kind of teases you with his ability to occasionally make threes and look good shooting the ball. Is just 2 of 9 this year for 22%. And Javon Pickett, you know, bless him, he's certainly not looking to shoot as much this year, but he's 1 for 8 on the year, and it's just like, so I mean, can Drew Smith get to 35%? He's at 33. I think, you know, you certainly hope that Mark Smith is a little bit more consistent. He has fewer nights like he did against Bradley, but there is sort of like this feeling that if they could just kind of get a little bit more consistent shooting the ball, and not even like scorching the nets, just be a little bit better. Instead of like having a 25% shooting team, you have a 28% shooting team. I just think that that's going to help them, in those games that are within a possession or two, and turn them into more easy wins.
Yeah, because I think what we're having again is I've seen people and fans at least have asked me like, what's happening with this offense? Zoe's not running really complex offense. Well, no, he stripped the offense back to make it really simple. Like, you can watch, and if you watch closely enough, you can figure out what Missouri's 3 or 4 base sets are. Like, it's like the actions and the options off of them can be diverse, but like, it's not hard to sit and watch 2 or 3 Missouri games and like sit there with a pen and paper and diagram their 5 most used sets. It's not a scouting issue. It's not like, you know, are they being all that complex? Or are they being, you know, nuanced with it? It's the reason why I like the offense is it stripped it back. You know, it made the decisions easy. But the question is, how are they executing it? Like, you and I have talked about, or at least I have talked about, like, if you watched the first half the other night, you know, Xavier Pinson's reads out of pick and rolls were not very good in terms of when he was deciding to drop the ball, where he was deciding to put, when he wanted to pass, or reading some of the coverages. Like, that's not a scheme issue. That's a guy who's got to make decision issues. If you create a good kickout opportunity to a shooter like Mark, it's got to be a knockdown opportunity. He's got to hit that shot. Like, there's a certain point at which, like, being creative with scheme, as you mentioned, doesn't overcome the inherent personnel you have. Like, you can scheme your way to get shots, but your guys have to make them, or they have to make the right read or the decision or convert. Like, Missouri got to the rim plenty of times. They just didn't convert. They shot, like, 40% at the rim. Like, if you get there, you got to finish plays.
And I think, like, that's one of the things that they've done well this year. Like, that's been the improvement in the offense, is they were converting around the rim, and then against Bradley, like, they weren't. And some of it is size. I mean, Bradley had size along the front line that I think, you know, that matches up well, like, with some SEC teams. So, I mean, it is going to be, I think what they've done so far, excluding the Bradley game, is they've been able to attack the rim and convert. What they didn't do against Bradley is convert. Now, the question becomes, was that a product of a bad night? Was it a product of, you know, Bradley? Was it a product of...
a layoff?
You know, there's a lot of different things that we aren't going to know, and we probably won't know unless we see it as like a trend 2-3 games into the SEC season.
Yeah. And this is where I've sort of looked at it, and I look at the numbers more than anyone else. The only thing I think you can definitively say, and I said it a couple minutes ago, was it's not a great shooting basketball team. It's just not. And I don't think it's a slight or rude or crass to say this team doesn't have very good shooters on it. And now maybe they'll absolutely go bonkers down the SEC portion of the schedule, but
there's going to be like one game this year where they probably go like 10 of 17 from 3-point range or something.
Well, this is what's happened. Like, in Konzo's first year, they shot 41% on open threes. In year two of Martin, they shot 37%. Last year it was 31. This year it's 30. Like, if the working theory of the case is that your guys improve as they get older, that's not applying here. And the only consistent shooter on that group for open threes has been Mark. So what it tells me is, like, what you're seeing in practice might be accurate, but in games when the lights come on, when we get the data that gets analyzed, this team's carryover to games then is not very good. And there's only so much you can do there. I mean, Konzo can't come out and take shots for them. Can't do it. And what you see is, and we've seen this against Liberty and Bradley, is it's very clear at halftime, it's he sees they're not knocking down jumpers, so let's get off the bounce and let's go to the rim. And that's when the foul count and the free throw rate gets up. And that's when you start to see them rally a bit. They're able to get some possession, some, you know, tempo going in spurts. And that's worked for them. But I think the only definitive thing we can say is this team does not shoot the ball well. If they have a good night, we shouldn't ask whether they're turning the corner at this point. We should just treat it as, okay, that was a good shooting night.
Yeah.
How many good shoot? And the question, and I'm not saying that, you know, to try and be provocative or anything, but the question for them is, how many good shooting nights are they going to have in the SEC, and can they get enough of them to help them along?
Yeah.
That's about all we can say coming out of the Bradley game. Outside of the rim finishing, like you said, if they're getting into SEC play and you start to see the two-point shooting take a hit and the conversion rate around the rim drop, then I think we can attribute that to the early season schedule than to personnel. But at this point, the only definitive thing I think we can say is they just don't shoot the ball very well.
So as they turn to SEC play, big test up front, Tennessee. For anyone who has been paying attention to college basketball this year, and if you're listening to this podcast, you probably have been a little bit. Tennessee is currently a top 10 team in Ken Pomeroy. Their preseason is all over the place. So they started the season on pause and opened up with a tough matchup at home against Colorado. Colorado is a top 30 level KenPom team. They're going to be a solid team in the Pac-12 this year. Cincinnati, they followed up with Cincinnati's not very good. And then they played Appalachian State, Tennessee Tech, St. Joseph's, which is their toughest matchup. St. Joe's 166 in KenPom. Basically slightly better than Oral Roberts. And then USC Upstate. So Tennessee really hasn't been challenged since their opening game. But this is a team that everybody liked coming into the season. There's a lot to like. They returned a bunch of dudes. John Fulkerson was awesome down the stretch of the year last year. They, you know, brought in Santiago Vescovi, who provided some stability at the point guard spot after Lamonte Turner decided to call it a year with a shoulder injury. And then, of course, like Yves Pons. Yves Pons is just a terrific athlete, phenomenal defender. A little bit of a liability on offense, but a guy that's so athletic, he kind of makes up for it here and there. And then they brought in like a really, really well-regarded recruiting class. Two guys, Keon Johnson, who is a lot of people think is going to be a lottery pick. Jaden Springer is another five-star freshman, kind of a combo forward. Another guy who's sort of floated as a potential lottery pick. And oh yeah, like Josiah Jordan-James, former five-star player who had an up-and-down year last year. But now he's back for year two. So this is, I mean, this is a roster with depth, with talent. Son of a true son, Victor Bailey, has been able to help them a little bit with one of their issues, which was outside shooting. He's become kind of a reliable shooter. But this is a really good Tennessee team. It's going to be a tough matchup. It's fortunate for Missouri they get them at home to start the season. But I think like this will tell you a lot about where the SEC schedule is going to go for the Tigers if they're able to play with, beat this Tennessee squad. Because this is a team that has got great length. They defend well. Their issues, they still have, even though I mentioned Vescovi brought them some stability at point guard, he's not the best ball handler. He's prone to turnovers. They're still kind of breaking in the freshmen. So, I mean, they're not like a flawless team. You're not going up against, you know, the, 72 Dolphins or anything like that. Like, you know, they're a team that's still figuring some things out, but they're certainly, I think, at this point, it's pretty clear they're the best team in the SEC, the most likely team to finish atop the standings. So getting one up on them to start the season would be kind of huge.
Vescovi starts for them, but they've kind of, over the course of the game, they will run Springer at the point. And he's, you know, Rick Barnes's offense doesn't need necessarily a real creative force at the point guard position. You know, he runs a modified version of flex and some other stuff, but that doesn't require him to have a truly elite point guard. So he can start Vescovi, but then he can move towards Springer. Bailey's a knockdown shooter who they needed last year. They could have used Bailey a year ago to keep the spacing right. Josiah Jordan-James has had a really, really good start. And I think he's a good case example for, like, sometimes five stars need a year, but he's been really, really good, grades out well defensively, shooting near 44% from three, just having a really nice year for them. Yves Pons, not shooting the ball well. He's kind of regressed as a shooter a little bit, but that's not why you have Pons on the floor. You have him there as a switch defender, a body guy, and he gets on the glass. Fulkerson's been really good so far for them down low. Converting around 50% from two, but bigger deal is he's drawing fouls and he's hitting free throws, rim protecting, rebounding. EJ Anasicki's in the rotation for them in the front court. Really good grad transfer, really physical guy. Brawny, who can give some minutes to Pons or can play at the five for them. Like we said in the preseason pod when we had Blake on, just they managed to keep the DNA of Barnes's first couple teams, which was filled with three-star guys who were grinders and who developed themselves into an elite team. That attitude is still there, and there are still guys like Fulkerson and Pons on the roster who can still, and even a guy like Olivier Nakuma who can keep that around. But then they just upgraded the talent level. They're long, they're athletic, they're physical around the rim and in the front court, which I think that's going to be the biggest sort of, you know, flashpoint in this game. Is I think Tennessee is going to be better at the four spot than Missouri. I think Fulkerson's a good rim protector who can have some, who's covered a little bit. You know, he's not the most athletic guy, but having, you know, guys like Nakuma or Pons in front of him who can switch is really helpful. They can get into passing lanes. They can cause problems. Just going to be a tough team defensively for Missouri to figure out. And we talked about the rim finishing issues for Missouri. This is a group right now that's seventh in the country in block percentage. They rim protect really well. They're 15th nationally in offensive rebound percentage defense. So Missouri in games has been able to either get on the glass or get to the rim and draw fouls. Tennessee doesn't foul. They don't give up rebounds, and they block shots. So setting aside the shooting issues here, which we know Missouri's going to likely struggle with, how are they going to manufacture offense if they get into the paint? That to me is the biggest question in this opener for them. If Tennessee's doing a good job defensively, this thing's going to be a slog. Tennessee's going to want to grind the pace down. I think Missouri has shown it's willing. It'll try and run opportunistically, but there's just part of me that thinks this is going to, it's going to be imperative for Missouri to try and eke out as many secondary breaks as it can and try and control tempo for enough of the game to give itself a shot. I think it's going to be really tough for them to score down in the paint. So they're going to have to find ways to manufacture easy buckets or easy points. That's the rub in this one.
Yeah, this is interesting to me because I do kind of think that, one, I think Tennessee benefits from a couple things. One, teams that have continuity have benefited early. That's Missouri, right? Tennessee also has that. But the difference between Missouri and Tennessee is Tennessee has also imported some truly elite talent. I know, like, there's a lot of people, and I've kind of seen, like, national previews and kind of stuff like that that really talk up a lot of the guys that were coming back for Tennessee. Look, I think Fulkerson's a really good player. But I mean, I just don't think he should be the best player on that team. And if he's the best player on that team, yeah, like I think, you know, if Fulkerson is the best player on the team, then that tells me that James or Keon Johnson or Springer didn't emerge like we thought that they should, didn't become kind of like the lottery pick. And it's kind of the same thing with Yves Pons. Like if Pons is on the floor taking shots, like that's a problem. Like Pons has never been a scorer. Vescovi is a good shooter, but as a ball handler, he's a bit careless. So the balance of continuity plus an influx of a good level of talent, and I think we've kind of seen it so far, was sort of anticipating that you would see Josiah Jordan James take that step up. And I think, like, that's probably the difference between Missouri and Tennessee right now is Tennessee has, you know, three guys who are probably going to play in the NBA, including one guy that already this year is looking like looking and playing like a pro prospect. I expect as the season wears on, you'll see more of Springer and Johnson. I think both those guys have flashed at times, but you know, Barnes has done a good job of just sort of bringing them on slowly and not you know, throwing the expectations of the team in the season onto their shoulders. But James is absolutely a guy that you can do that with at this point. And so I think if you're looking at the difference between those two rosters, like I still think Missouri is, with their continuity and the way that they play and the confidence that they have, they're a team that should be able to finish in the top four in the league, which is much more than I thought we were going to see coming into the season. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I would. And to your point about continuity, I think that continuity shows up on the defensive end of the floor. I think that's where you see guys like Fulkerson and Pons and some of their veterans sort of assert themselves, is in their defensive identity. Offensively, though, you can definitely tell they've upgraded. And like I said, James has taken a step forward. And I think when I mentioned Bailey earlier, I think Bailey's been integral because he sort of has given cover. He's produced enough to let Barnes bring Johnson and Springer along at a reasonable enough pace. And when one of those guys emerges, you could probably slide Bailey to more of a reserve role and still be okay. Like, I think what they've gotten right so far is Bailey's shooting well enough and the freshmen are flashing enough that Pons' regression gets covered up. Fulkerson is a guy who's developed and turned himself into a really good post player. But he doesn't have to be the focal point for them offensively. But defensively, when they go to that end of the floor, their vets know what they want to do. They buy in. They have an attitude. They have a philosophy. And they execute it. And I think that's what is going to be interesting in this game is you have two teams that I think are tough-minded defensively that can sit down. They don't mind doing it. They want to guard. They want to make you grind out long possessions. But as you said, Tennessee, I think Missouri does a great job. We've talked about it before in their scouting reports. They know what they want to do. They know what spots they want to give you on the floor to score from. But Tennessee's got three dudes who can still go get a bucket. And I think that's really the difference between these two teams. We talk about Missouri having to really find hacks or find ways to pick the lock or find workarounds. Tennessee's is, I'm going to give the ball I can give it to Josiah Jordan James and he can go. I can give it to Keon Johnson, and he can go. I can give it to Jaden Springer, and he can go. And I think that there's that kind of level of sort of relief on the Tennessean that, okay, if Missouri scouts us well, we've still got three dudes. And that's something Missouri doesn't have right now. But I think this is a test more for if Missouri wins it. I don't know if it's necessarily planting a flag so much as it is, okay, if they get into a race for a top four spot, and we're talking tiebreakers between having fourth and fifth, having a win over Tennessee in your back pocket is going to be really, really handy for them. I think the bigger game early on is the trip to Arkansas. To me, that's a tough road trip, but Bud Walton won't have people in it. Arkansas is a team that has looked okay at times, but at other stretches, they've looked like a team that's clearly trying to figure out how they fit together.
They also have not team that scheduled.
We have no clue how tough they are because the schedule's been so off. And
yeah,
they were trying to get a game against Tulsa, but COVID knocked that out. So we have no clue like what they're going to look like against a top-end Power 5 team. But that's a game where if you're going to ask for two more comparable teams, it's probably, like at least in terms of where we think they're going to be in the standings, that road trip to Fayetteville is pretty big to me. If you lose to Tennessee and it's a tough loss, yeah, missed opportunity. But I think if you can go into Fayetteville and get a win and then you go to Mississippi State, which I think you mentioned earlier, has really only one offensive threat. If you can go 2-1 and look good against Tennessee, I still think you've achieved a lot of the objectives for early in the non-conference play. I think the problem is if Tennessee blows your doors off and then you go to Arkansas and things get sideways. Then I think you start to maybe wonder if the bolts are rattling a little bit, but Tennessee is going to be an opportunity for them to obviously get a game that you wouldn't expect them to get, but it also can help them down the stretch if they're in a tight race for a double bye in the SEC tournament or a top four finish.
Well, we've talked about like that 3-4 game stretch to open SEC play kind of since the beginning of the schedule. And I do think that what you're looking for in the first three is to go 2-1, or what you're hoping for is to go 2-1. If you go 2-1, wins against whoever, losses against whoever, like even a road game at Mississippi State, if you lose that, but you beat Tennessee and Arkansas, like, I think people are still feeling okay. Hey, you had a bad game.
Yeah.
I mean, Mississippi State is, they're not very good. Like that, just, they're frankly, they are going to be probably one of the three or four worst teams in the league, but they're certainly better than I thought they'd be. You know, they struggled to score the ball against Clemson. They did lose to Liberty. Went to overtime against Dayton. And I mean, all of their wins are, I mean, everybody's boat racing Mississippi Valley State. But I mean, they when I've watched them, I thought they looked better than I thought they would.
They have not been a car wreck.
And it's kind of like team that you and I were discussing and this is not a SLU pod, but you and I were kind of discussing with SLU about, you know, like the expectation of them, you know, being able to go and beat Minnesota on the road, like, shouldn't really exist. Like, Minnesota's a top 50 team, and like, that's not an unrealistic loss. If anything, like, Minnesota probably should have expected to win that game against a top 30 level SLU team. Missouri is 40th in KenPom right now. Mississippi State is 80th. That's a one possession game on the road. So
yep.
I think what you do is you hope for 2-1. You you absolutely have to do at least 1-2. You cannot go 0-3. I think that they will at least get to 1-2. I think that based upon what I've seen this year, I think they will probably get, like, I'm like 65% sure they'll be 2-1.
The bigger deal to me is what comes after those first three games. You get LSU at home, you get Vandy at home, you go to A&M, and you get South Carolina at home. To me, that's wedged between the trip to Mississippi State and a return trip to Knoxville. If you go 2-1, and then you get three home games, and LSU has some talent back, but LSU still doesn't play defense. They still struggle with perimeter defense. Missouri has shown in the past they can take advantage of how LSU wants to defend. So if you can go 2-1, get LSU at home, get two out of Vandy, A&M, and South Carolina, and basically sit at 5-2 in the first seven games, you are in tall cotton. I think that's 4-3 is fine. You're not hurting there. You put that with your non-conference performance, you're still feeling good about where you are. But if you're 5-2, and if one of those wins is over Tennessee, then I think you can start to look down the back half of the stretch, the final 10 or 12 games, and think, okay, now we are in a position to start playing for seeding position, not just in the SEC tournament, but in the NCAA tournament. So the first two games here, the first three games, we're going to focus on them a lot because I just think you want to get out of the blocks quickly. But those four games that sort of come, that next four-game block, to me, is where if you started 2-1, you can really begin to assert yourself in the race. And given the non-conference you had, you can really start to think about decent position, you know, playing for the stakes of decent positioning in March down the stretch. So that's sort of how I break up the first kind of like four-game chunks of the SEC slate.
And if they win their first three games, like, that definitely also leaves a lot of room for them to work with the rest of the way. Like,
yeah,
like I feel like that's kind of the thing with Missouri. Like, you know, the last few years they've gotten off to such bad starts in SEC play that it just, like, it's, even though, like, last year they finished, you know, pretty strong, they finished 7-11. That opening stretch where it was just like, I think at one point they were like what, 1-5?
At one point, they were 1-5, yeah.
And it's just like,
and then
that's just, it's a little, it's a lot to overcome. So if you could start out 3-0, or you definitely want to get to 2-1, I think what you're doing is you're setting yourself up to kind of be in command and be in that, 6-1, 6-2 kind of area, which allows you some bumps along the road. So if you drop a road game, at Mississippi State, drop a road game at Mississippi, or lose to Texas A&M, something like that, where it maybe doesn't look great on individual level, but you took care of business early, then I think that can really help. And that's what I think we're kind of hoping for this Missouri team, because they're in the position of sort of where a lot of teams haven't been, of having that continuity, having the ability to be together and win some games. So
yeah, if you go three and one out of Tennessee, Arkansas, Mississippi State, and LSU, at that point you're going to have more quad one wins than you did last year, and you still have 14-15 games left on the schedule. That point, you don't want to tank the rest of the way, and you don't want to completely let the foot off the gas, but I just think this team in the program in the last 2 years has been in a position where it plays well enough and it shows enough fortitude, but it's just chasing the game a bit, the bigger game overall. Of they're always 2 to 3 wins behind where they need to be. And I think and I'll circle back to Bradley briefly. Like, I think people were like looking at this game and sort of talking about it, and like, of course they earn a number 14 ranking and lose. I don't think Missouri's the 14th best team in the country. I don't think Jeff Goodman has them 11th right now. I don't think they're the 20th best team in the country. I think, I said this about SLU. I think on a good day, Missouri and SLU are borderline top 25 teams. I think at the end of the day, if they have good years, they are going to be 6 or 7 seeds in the NCAA tournament. What Bradley was about holding serve, and not that taking a loss to a Missouri Valley favorite would have been bad, but it's just something you don't need. Like, I think that coming out of that game, it was Missouri's season was not torpedoed if they lost that game. If they had, I would not have been like, oh God, of course they get a 14 ranking and they handle it poorly and fall out. I think at some point Missouri's going to slide down in the rankings a bit and they may fall out. I think the bigger deal for beating Bradley was less about maintaining a ranking, less about perception than it was. The end of the day, the job for this team is to get to an NCAA tournament. That's what this program needs. It needs to be playing substantial basketball in March. It could be as a 6 seed. It could be as a 10 seed. The goal is to get a bid. That's what they need, because next year is likely a reset, barring something happening in spring or guys coming back who we don't expect to. But I think everyone sort of looks at the game, and we do it too. We fall into it where we kind of get locked into that one data point. But Missouri, what it did against Bradley was it just didn't burn any insurance or capital that it didn't need to. Now it gets to go in and it gets to, in the first 5 to 7 games of the SEC stretch, really kind of put a little bit more turns on the bolt in terms of where they are as having a good NCAA tournament resume. The individual results matter, but I think when you look at the aggregate picture here, what beating Bradley did was it kept them on track. They're going to hit some bumps. They're probably going to fall out of the top 25 at some point. Irrelevant. Can they continue making steady progress towards a bid in March? That's where I come down. If they stay ranked, all the better. If they become a top 20 team in KenPom, great. Mission critical here is to get an NCAA tournament bid. And that's what they were able to continue doing by beating Bradley. And where they are going into SEC play.
So, I think I agree with most of that. The as high as Missouri is ranked right now, I think it's more of a product of the way the season has started for college basketball in general and for Missouri. You know, expectations were a little too high for Illinois, I think. I don't really think they were a top 10 team. I don't think they are a top 10 team. Oregon was a nice win, but also, like we've mentioned, missing some kind of key components. Missouri is better than I think we expected them to be, but not by a large stretch. So I really think, like, it's the things that we've kind of talked about. This is a good basketball team. They are going to win more games than they have any of the previous few seasons here, or at least from a percentage wise, considering we may not get a whole lot of games in. But I think we are excited about watching basketball for the first time in a long time this year. And a lot of that is the product of just having a team that is capable of making winning plays. You saw a team capable of making winning plays against Illinois. You saw it against Bradley. You saw it against Oregon. You saw it against Liberty. And I think that will continue through the season. And, you know, whether it's 11-7 or whether they can find a way to, you know, win 13 games, who knows? In SEC play. I always equate things to SEC play. I think anything's possible for this team because it's such a weird year, and the way that they're capable of playing and the way that they're sort of matching their opponent is important. And I certainly think we're going to discover a lot about them next Wednesday. So you and I are going to record, I guess, after the Tennessee game. We'll have a good idea of what's going on. And then we at some point, I think we'll probably get back to our more normal schedule of recording after the Saturday game, probably on Sunday or Monday. But for now, it's Christmas Eve. Everybody, hope this is something that you could listen to while you're wrapping presents or whatever. Merry Christmas. Don't get COVID. And make sure that you're subscribed. If you have nice things to say, say them on the podcast feed at Apple. Leave us nice reviews. All complaints, just go to an email to Mitch. And follow us on Twitter. We're occasionally entertaining sometimes. Right, Matt?
Yeah, we try to be. We try to be.
Any last words before we exit?
Merry Christmas, everyone. Thanks for listening. Thanks for reading. Thanks for following. It's nice to know there are people out there that care about niche Missouri basketball content. But you exist, and we're glad that you choose us to be the purveyor of your content.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll be back next week with more Dive Cuts.